We will continue our meditation on Jesus. We looked at his compassion, which reveals the compassion of God, of course. And now I want to look at Jesus' trusting obedience to his Father. The Gospels all begin with the baptism of Jesus. There is a prologue, I know, in John, and there's a couple of chapters in Matthew and Luke that prepare the stage, but the first scene in the public ministry of Jesus is the one I'll take you to now. It's his baptism. In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Just as he was coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens torn apart. Please don't imagine Jesus looking up and seeing clouds and all that. This is actually a quote from the book of Isaiah, where they prayed that the heavens would be torn apart and God would reveal himself. So Mark, writing to people familiar with this imagery, is saying that prayer was answered at the baptism. The heavens were torn apart, and the Spirit of God descended on Jesus like a dove. If you've been reading the Gospel of Mark, John the Baptist would have been preparing for something a bit different to this, something much more energetic and perhaps even violent. But the Spirit that descended on Jesus was not like anything the prophets expected. Forest being, a tornado rushing through a forest, or fire, or a lion growling in the undergrowth. No, it was like a dove, very gentle, introducing a spring, a new life. And here's the point. A voice came from heaven. Well, Jesus experienced, in other words, profoundly, something he'd known all his life, but not quite like this. You're my son. You're the one I love. I'm delighted with you. And whatever Jesus' religious experience in the first 30 or so years of his life, we're not told anything about it, really. So let's leave it. This significant moment, overwhelming experience, precisely of being loved. And it was so powerful that it took him into a desert, a wilderness, to, like Paul really, in Arabia. But it took Jesus to try and see what this meant, because he knew that it wasn't just for him. This wasn't something unique to him. And in that wilderness experience, he came to see that this is exactly what was wrong with his world. That the Mary of Magdalene and the thieves and the lepers and the fishermen, they knew a lot of things. They went to the synagogue. They knew their catechism, as it were. But they didn't know how delighted God was in them. That's what their problem was. So Jesus' mission, as you know, is in a way very simple. He knew something about everyone he met. They didn't yet know that they're a son or daughter of God and they're loved and God is delighted in them. So no wonder that for those who are open to Jesus' ministry, this attracted them in such a way that they stopped doing all the silly things that we can fill our life with, and a Mary of Magdala becomes a Saint Mary of Magdala, and so on, because they know they're loved. After a busy day of loving, healing, as the sun set, they were bringing to Jesus all who were sick or possessed with demons. In other words, psychologically sick as well. And the whole city was gathered around the door, and he cured many who were sick with various diseases, and he cast out many demons. That's the way they understood sickness that's here, psychic, nervous. I'm not saying the demons don't exist, but I don't think we should be too bothered with them. This is just a psychological sickness, which we know now is just as physical as any other sickness. But they didn't know it then, and they didn't know it in the Middle Ages, and we've only learnt it a bit recently. In the morning, while it was still very dark, Jesus got up and went out to a deserted place. And there he was praying. Well, he was always in prayer, obviously. But he also needed to just get a bit of space and distance and to be alone with the alone. Now, Simon and his companions searched everywhere, and when they found him, they said to him, "Look, everyone's looking for you, for God's sake. Come on. We've got some coffee waiting for you to give you a bit of energy, but get into it." And here we know what Jesus was praying about. "Let us go to the neighbouring towns so that I may proclaim the message there too, for message. Show them how God loves them. That's what I came to do." So in prayer, of course he wanted to go back to Capernaum and the people that were there. Who wouldn't? All night he prayed about it, and he discerned that God actually wanted him to go elsewhere. So he went throughout Galilee proclaiming the message in their synagogues and healing people, or every part of us. And love is psychologically a very, particularly very healing. "I've come to," Jesus, why did he come? This is how he saw it. "I've come to cast fire on the earth. And I wish it were blazing already." Another beautiful way where we have Jesus' own sense of his mission. "I've come that you may live and live to the full." If anyone ever teaches you or me something, it may happen to be right, but if it's not about life, and if it doesn't connect, and if it doesn't encourage us to live to the full, it's not the gospel, it's not from God. The best, it might be good and you mightn't be ready for it, whatever, but don't take any notice of it. If I thump the pulpit and tell you what God wants you to do, well, ring up my GP and say he needs help. Because Jesus came to live, that we may live and live to the full. It's all about that. In fact, if you allow me a distraction, when I was at Chevalier, oh God, 50 years ago, I think it is, isn't it? I was teaching for 3 years there, and I was young enough, and I was keen, and the kids were good, as kids always are, and I used to go into the top year, sixth form, leaving certificate it was then, and give them the religion stuff, and they were all waiting to practice for rugby union. They were all bigger than me too, probably. But I used to put on the board that phrase. Every time they came in, they'd see it sitting there. "I've come that you may live and live to the full." And I'd say to them at the beginning of class, "If anything I say to you doesn't sound like that, you get into me because I've got it wrong." They used to. Because it is all about live, life. Watch Jesus now. I'll take you through it quietly. Jesus doesn't speak his own words. He's speaking those of his Father. He's speaking what he's heard in prayer. I won't give you the references, they're all there. Some little thing down the back too with some of these in it. He whom God has sent speaks the words of God. He gives the Spirit without measure, says John. Jesus answered the Jews, my teaching is not mine. It's his who sent me. Anyone who resolves to do the will of God will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own. I do nothing on my own, said Jesus. This is all from John's Gospel. I speak these things as the Father instructed me. And the one who sent me is with me. He hasn't left me alone. I always do what's pleasing to him. Wouldn't it be great to be able to say that? But anyhow, Jesus could say it. I've much to say about you and much to condemn, he says. But the one who sent me is true, and I declare to the world what I've heard from him. Where? In prayer, obviously. I declare what I've seen in the Father's presence. Just as Paul declared what he saw on the road to Damascus. I declare what I've seen in my Father's presence. As for you, you should do what you've heard from the Father. You're trying to kill me, said Jesus. A man has told you the truth that I heard from God. So in rejecting me, you're rejecting God, says Jesus. Don't you believe that I'm in the Father and the Father is in me? The words I say to you, I don't speak as from myself. The word that you hear is not mine, it's from the Father who sent me. The words, he prays to the Father, the Last Supper, the words that you gave to me, I've given to them, so and they have received them and know in truth that I came from you. They're not just saying, oh Jesus, you're a great mate. They're not falling in love with Jesus. Well, they are, but that's not the end of it. They came to see that, hey, this is what God is like. The whole image of God shifted. It took time, of course, but it shifted beautifully and kept shifting all their life. They believe that you sent me. That's the key. God sent him. Well, I've given you a dozen texts, all from John. I think they're convincing enough, aren't they? That Jesus' words came out of his prayer, out of his communion with God. What about his actions? Again, John. And he's trying to show us the divinity of Jesus. In other words, the intimate communion between the man Jesus and the mystery we call God. Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and complete his work. His work. Jesus didn't come to love, he came to give God's love. John 5, the Jews started persecuting Jesus because he was doing such things, healing, on the Sabbath. And Jesus answered them, my Father is still working. He doesn't stop on the Sabbath. Well, Genesis, eat your heart out. They got it wrong. It was a nice thing they said. And it fits with Sabbath and sabbaticals and everything. But Jesus is going deeper than all that. That's all fine, but the Father is still working, creating, loving, healing. And I am doing it too. Sabbath or not Sabbath? Jesus said to them, "Very truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing on his own. Only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. The Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing." I can do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just because I seek to do not my own will, but the will of the one who sent me. So there's constant discernment, communion. And it was often difficult, but always beautiful. "The deeds that the Father has given me to complete, the very deeds that I'm doing testify that the Father has sent me." Can't you see that he's saying to them? You've got your ideas of God and you've locked God into a system and it's not all wrong, but it's all very imperfect. Can't you see that what I'm doing with you is what God is doing? And if it contradicts things you grew up with, drop them. Jesus said, "When you've lifted up the Son of Man, then you'll know that I am ego, eimi, ho'on," the halo around Jesus' head in the icons. In other words, you'll see God. I do nothing on my own. It's the Father living in me who's doing this. So he's all the time... We know this, but we need to be reminded. He's all the time pointing the way. He's a sign. He's a symbol. He's a sacrament of God. He's an incarnation, a human expression of God. These are phrases we're struggling with to try and get the mystery of it all, but they're good. It's the Father living in me who's doing this work, he says. "I glorified you," he says to the Father on earth, "by finishing the work that you gave me to do." John of the Cross has a haunting, blooming phrase that haunts me, obviously, and I'm about to haunt you. He says, "What's the good of giving God one thing when he asked for something else?" Back to Paul's poem on love. What's the good of all those things in those early verses if there's no love there? And to sum it up, Jesus doesn't carry out his own will, but that of the Father. His words come from his communion. His deeds flow from this communion, because it's God doing it in him. It's not Jesus doing it. And now, Jesus said to them, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me." Well, of course, if Jesus experienced in the baptism a culmination of a whole educative process, and he had a beautiful mother, and Joseph wasn't too bad either, so he's got all this happening, but in his early 30s, he's overwhelmed with the feeling, the knowledge, the faith, that he's immensely loved by God. Why wouldn't he want to do God's will? And want others to do it too, because it's so beautiful. "I can do nothing on my own," he says. "I seek to do not my own will, but the will of the one who sent me. I've come down from heaven, not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." Come down from heaven really means I'm sent by God. Don't get too physical and imaginative about it or whatever. This is simple language for saying that's where he's coming from. Coming from the baptism experience. "The one who sent me is with me. He hasn't left me alone. I always do what is pleasing to him." I know him. And know in the Bible is a very simple, beautiful word. It never means know about. I mean, it's good to know about. It's fine. But to know means communion. To know the way we know through intimacy. The way we experience in love. So that's the knowing he has. I know him. And I keep his word. You are my son. I delight in you. Jesus cried out, whoever believes in me is not believing in me. Get that straight, he's saying. You're believing in the one who sent me. Whoever sees me sees the one who sent me. I've come as a light to the world, so that everyone who believes in me shouldn't remain in the dark. And he lived in a very dark world. Don't you believe that I'm in the Father and the Father is in me? The words I say to you, I don't speak as of myself. It's the Father living in me who's doing this. So he's always pointing, as you'd expect, from himself to the mystery we call God, revealing who God really is. And it was very different from what everyone had learned. And it can be different from what you and I have learned. You must believe me when I say that I'm in the Father and the Father is in me. Believe me on the evidence of what I'm doing, if for no other reason. Get out of your theology and your scholastic interpretations and everything and just experience it. And you'll know, because it's about life. Therefore, it's about God. And now I come, and I'll be slower on this one, to this extraordinary intimate scene. That painting belongs, we had an MSC priest, in fact he was teaching me here, had the privilege of that one from 1950 to something else, it's a long time ago, and he's an artist and he's done these many, spent the last few years of his life, I'm not exactly how many, Dominic would know, but painting Stations of the Cross, he did many of them. This is one of them, clearly the agony. And may I read it to you? They went to a place called Gethsemane. He said to his disciples, you sit here while I pray. And he clearly didn't want to be alone. So he, and the others all must have understood. He got his three closest companions. He took them with him. And he began to be distressed and agitated. Very poor translation. The Greek, I'm told, is he had a breakdown. Like he just broke down. I'm deeply grieved, he said, even to death. Stay here, keep awake. I need you, keep awake. And then he also needed to be alone, but not alone. So going a little farther, he threw himself on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass him by. He's intelligent, for God's sake. And he's been opposed by this group and the vultures are circling. And he saw something in the eyes of Judas too that troubled him for Judas. And so it's all getting a bit tight. So the likelihood of a confrontation is looming, and he knows it. So he prays for time. Maybe like a mother with dying of cancer at 35 with four little children. it's too early to die, so they want time to be with the little ones. Jesus wanted time to be with, because they're not ready. Peter's not ready, and John's not ready, and James isn't ready, and the others are nowhere near ready. And nothing's changed much. Romans are still doing what they're doing, and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the high priest are prancing around making edicts for everybody. Who's got the message? As far as Jesus knows, maybe no one's quite got it. Well, I think his mother might have been pretty good, and there would have been others, but it's all a bit iffy. It's unfinished business. He's got a mission to do, and he's failed, it would appear, and he felt that, I think. So he said, "Father, Abba," very intimate and lovely, "everything's possible to you. Take this cup away. Give me time yet. Help me really love these people, to tell them the beauty of your love, because they haven't got it yet. And if things get grim with the Romans and the rest, well." But he ends in a beautiful place where you and I are asked to come to too, in small ways and big. "Not my will, but yours be done." Now this little immensely logical head of mine for years didn't trouble me too much, because I had good parents and a good home, and I was scatterbrained, so I let things go over my head all right. But people who were more intense than I am, or more earnest, or more whatever, took a lot of this in. I read that as meaning, well, it's obvious. My will is I don't want to die. Your will is that I die, so I'll do your will. QED, clear enough? You're all happy with that? It's crazy, but that's what it could look like. So I think I grew up thinking, or somewhere in my head, it soon got washed away by theology, but that God somehow sent Jesus onto the earth. I don't know how you can send Jesus onto the earth anyhow, because he starts on the earth, the way we all start, in the womb of your mother. Anyhow, so Jesus' mission on the earth, that's a better way to put it, was to die. And dying on a cross, God couldn't think of a better way to save everybody. That's really great. Makes God sound really, really intelligent and attractive. And it's nice if God arranges to have his son murdered so that I'll be saved. How beautiful is that? Hang on, let's start again. What about if the thing Jesus really, really, really knew, God doesn't plan injustice to achieve a loving end? God doesn't. God's not into murder, injustice. He's not into mortal sins. Jumping a bit, Pilate washing his hands isn't doing God's will, for God's sake. The high priest getting up and saying he must be crucified is not doing God's will. Who's doing God's will in that mob? Jesus. And maybe others are struggling, but what about, and you imagine this better yourself, what about if Jesus' breakdown was because he knew, I'll come back on that he failed his mission? He only ever wanted the world to know how loving God is. But hardly anybody has understood or truly believed. Maybe Jesus thought, I'm only maybe-ing here, that maybe he shouldn't have come to Jerusalem, and maybe it was a mistake to empty the temple. He couldn't help himself when he went in there, all this junk is going on, and he said, this is a place of prayer, and he burst into a wonderful, loving anger. But maybe he's now thinking, oh God, maybe I should have been. Maybe I shouldn't have been so direct with the Pharisees. I only did it to try and love them and wake them up. But how wise was it? I don't know what he was going through. He's going through a lot of stuff. And he comes to a beautiful place where he says, none of this is making sense to me, but I know what I'll do. I'll do my Father's will. Meaning, I'll keep embracing lepers, come what may. I'll keep eating with sinners, come what may. I'll keep confronting, in love of course, shaking the foundations of institutions that have lost it or held God in or whatever. I'll keep doing that. I'll keep doing what I learned to do from my baptism experience in those times in the wilderness. I'll keep loving people, God, Dad, Father. It's over to you, but that's all I can do, and I'm going to keep doing it. So he did it. So he rose from the agony, strong, clear, and he did it beautifully. And you and I could be saved, not because Jesus was murdered. We're not saying, thank you, Pilate, or thank you, High Priest, how lovely you were doing God's will. They weren't doing God's will. But we're saying thank you to Jesus because, why? Because in that darkest place, he never stopped believing and loving. And they're the same thing, really. Believe, if you look at the English word, comes made up of two words, be and leave, lifter, liebe, love. To believe is to be in love. So the agony of Jesus is just the, I mean, it was like that all his life. And we've seen hundreds of quotes to make that point. But here in this deep, deep, deep place of agony, struggle, he held on to what he knew was right. To do his Father's will. And please don't think that his Father wanted him to die. He wanted him to live and live to the full. It was the people all around him, some of them in there, who wanted him dead, not God. In fact, that's in the parable of Jesus. There's a lot of parables, as you know. But this parable's out on its own. It's right at the end of the gospel. And it's quite lovely. Jesus tells this story about a man who had an orchard or something and had people, whatever. And he sent people in to servants to pick up what he was due. And they killed them or murdered them or bashed them up or all this. And no one's listening, like the story of the prophets in a way. And then it says this lovely line that comes out of Jesus' mind, and it shows you what he thought of God. The owner of the vineyard said he still had someone else to send. His beloved son. Finally, he sent him to them, saying, brackets, I'd like them to kill him so that the world can be saved. Doesn't say that. What the father said was, surely thou respect my son. Okay, they didn't listen to Jeremiah too well, and they didn't listen to Isaiah, and they didn't listen to Amos, and they didn't listen to Hosea, and they didn't listen to John the Baptist, and you could make a list as big. But surely to God they'll listen to my son, because everyone wants to be loved. And once they see that I am loved and that he is loving them, the world will wake up to itself and people will get on with loving, surely. But they don't. They kill him and throw him out of the vineyard. Jesus says in John 8, you look for an opportunity to kill me. And he doesn't say because that's God's secret plan from all eternity. God had this in mind. Let's get rid of that. Sorry if you've never heard that before. Forget I said it. That image, but I think you probably did hear it somewhere else. No, he said, you're looking for an opportunity to kill me, not because you're keen to do my father's will, but because there's no place in you for my word. It's because you're not listening to God that you want to kill me. It's because you're not listening to God that you murder an innocent man, says the church, says the New Testament. It's because you're not listening to God. But if you go to Calvary, and I go to Calvary, we don't ask, why did God organize the death of Jesus? God didn't organize it. We're not saying, why didn't God intervene? Because God doesn't intervene. Look at Biafra, look at Syria, look at... God loves, and if anyone loves, God is intervening, if you're going to use that word. But intervening means he's not there and then he is there, and he's not there and he is there. God is totally present all the time, loving everybody and inspiring everyone to live to the full and let others live to the full. That's what God's doing. But he's not organising everything. He's not a puppeteer. He respects our freedom. He respected Hitler's freedom, and he respects everyone's freedom. They want to kill Jesus because they're not listening. Luke picks that all up beautifully, and the author of that bronze statue, you can see Jesus, can't you, in the center of it, on the cross. But he captures, it's brilliant. In the one moment, you've got Jesus dying and, I won't say rising, but exalted, believing, loving. Jesus cried with a loud voice and said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. He never stopped believing in God, even in that awful place, because he knew God wasn't dead. He knew that, yes, he, like everybody else, has to live in an imperfect world where there's sin and infidelity and fear and hate and all the rest of it. So he's in that world too, but he, into your hands I commend my spirit. And with that he breathed forth his spirit. Mark says, when the centurion who stood facing Jesus saw, please read it carefully, how he died, not that he died. God, he saw people dying all the time. There's another two just that afternoon. And every now and a few days there'd be people getting, this was his job, poor centurion. No, but he'd never seen this before. He'd never seen somebody die like this. How he died. With such forgiveness, love, prayer, faith, communion, trust, obedience, meaning listening to the love that's not apparent in the physical world, but very real. The centurion who stood facing and saw how he died said, truly this man was God's son. The baptism words. And I conclude this now with a hymn, Only in God.
shall.